Jesus is not the reason for the season, because seasonal celebrations in December, including birthday celebrations for gods on December 25th, existed long before Jesus would have been born, and long before the church started celebrating anything in regards to anything at this time. And basically, Jesus was tacked on to existing celebrations. And so he is not the original reason that we celebrate at this time of year.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode,
8-legged white flying horses, Christmas sex, and stuffing bad children into bags.
All coming up next. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett.
I'm Kim Ellington.
And welcome back. How are you, Kim?
I'm good, Bo. How are you?
Good. I'm in the Christmas mood. You know why?
Why?
Because we're going to be speaking with somebody all about Christmas.
Yay! I'm not quite excited yet, although, you know, because I love Thanksgiving. It's one of my favorite. We actually have an autumn tree in our house. Like, it's covered in all of the fun pumpkins and all the wonderful dark orange, red, yellow fall colors. Nice. But coming back from a free thought meeting last night, I did see a house completely lit up, all their lights out, and I did get a twinge of excitement. I do love some lights, Bo.
So the tree in your house, the autumn tree, is this a real tree or a dead tree or a fake tree? I mean, what is it?
It is our holiday seasonal tree. We started out with a Christmas tree, and then as we've evolved as a family, it gets changed, and so it stays up until January, and then it becomes a Valentine's Day tree. We have a spring tree, a summer tree. We have whatever season. Sometimes we have a 4th of July tree, an Independence Day tree.
What a great
idea.
And
this year it's a Falloween, so it has some Halloween stuff left on it, but it's mostly just gorgeous fall colors.
That's a great idea. So I'm taking it is a fake tree. It's not.
It is. Not real. Okay. Yeah.
Because otherwise you would never be able to keep it up all year.
No, around. And it would probably be pretty smelly by now.
Yeah. That's a great idea.
Yeah. So what have you been up to?
Well, I just came back from Skepticon.
Ah, Skepticon. Skepticon. How was that?
The nation's largest free secular skeptic conference.
Amazing.
Yeah. It was good. I had a lot of fun there. It was just a lot of fun. Different experience. Different from what I've experienced before at other humanist atheist conferences. I did a presentation called The Psychology of Woo on this big stage, and it was really well received, and I'm excited about it. I'm looking forward to it coming out on YouTube soon.
Yes, I happen to have seen that presentation and like it very, very much, but I have to admit I'm quite biased because I like you, but it actually is unbiasedly a pretty good combination of psychology and pop psychology and fake psychology, and you explain it all. I love it.
Excellent. Well, usually I'm pretty against bias, but in this case, I'm all for it. So take the bias and
I like Bo.
It.
I like Bo's presentations. I'm pretty open about that.
All right.
So who are we talking to today?
We're going to be speaking with Dr. David Kyle Johnson, and he's an associate professor of philosophy at King's College in Pennsylvania, and he wrote this very entertaining and educational book, The Myths That Stole Christmas. So we're going to be talking to him about a few of those myths. So let's get him on the line. And Kim and I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. David Kyle Johnson, author of the book, The Myths That Stole Christmas. How are you, sir?
Hi, Bo. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. It's good to have you on here, The Humanist Hour, and what a perfect time to talk about your book. Your book is all about Christmas and the myths that stole them.
That's right.
Why don't you give us the 2-minute summary of your book?
Basically, I'm arguing that there's 7 misconceptions that hijack the holiday. 7 ideas that many people believe about the holidays that are untrue, that have basically made the holiday worse. Mm-hmm. It's made it harder on us to celebrate. It's made our celebrations less enjoyable. They also damage society. These myths help damage society in certain kinds of ways, economically, socially, politically. I have a lengthy chapter on the effect of the Santa Claus lie, I think, on children's thinking skills, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so these myths have damaged this in a certain kind of way. And so what I'm trying to do with the book basically is educate in a certain kind of way and expose the myths to reveal what they are, because once we realize they are myths, it's easier to change the way that we celebrate and make Christmas kind of work for us instead of against us, make it work for us again. It's really hard to change, especially when it comes to traditions. It's really hard to change traditions if you think that they there's a long-lasting tie to the past. And once you realize that, oh, this tradition is actually pretty new, it's a lot easier to give it up. And so that kind of education about these things, and especially once you realize it's damaging as well, it can be a lot easier to give these things up. So that's basically the thrust.
Okay.
Can we talk about, now you say that the Santa Claus lie is damaging to children and their critical thinking, and I have read a lot of stuff that says exactly the opposite. So would you like to expound on that? Because I'm fascinated.
Yeah, so I don't argue that it is necessarily damaging. In other words, I'm not arguing that every child that is exposed to the Santa Claus lie or is tricked into believing that Santa Claus literally exists will end up being a credulous thinker, right? I'm a counterexample, I would like to think. So I'm not a credulous thinker, but I believed in Santa Claus when I was a little kid, right? But I think that it's dangerous. And that it can, credulous thinking is only one of the actual worries I have about the Santa Claus lie. But let me speak to your worry about, or your concern about studies or arguments to the contrary. Usually what these, so let me get country specific on one of them. The kinds of arguments I usually come across when I'm researching this is the idea that Santa Claus belief is good for kids because it promotes imagination and imaginative play. And of course, imagination and imaginative play is very beneficial for kids, right? And I'm definitely not arguing against the benefits of imagination. But what that kind of argument seems to fail to realize is that, for one, I'm not arguing that kids shouldn't pretend that or can't pretend that Santa Claus exists or something like that. What I'm arguing against is parents tricking their children into literally believing that Santa Claus literally exists. And there's numerous reasons for that, but one of the reasons that is so objectionable and that it doesn't have the benefits that these psychologists often suggest when it comes to imaginative play is that tricking children into literally believing something doesn't promote imagination. To imagine something is to know that it's false, but pretend that it's true anyway. That's what requires imagination, right? The Christian doesn't imagine that Jesus rose from the dead. The Muslim does not imagine that Muhammad rode a horse named Barak up to heaven. They believe these things, right? And the same thing is true with kids. We're not tricking our kids into imagining that Santa Claus exists. We're tricking them into believing that he exists. But by doing so, we're actually robbing them of the opportunity to imagine that he exists. So one of the things that I suggest in the book is that instead of tricking them into literally believing that he exists, what you could do is kind of play the game and pretend that he exists. And they can play that game along with you, but as soon as they're old enough to know the difference between fact and fiction and ask for the truth, you either outright tell them, no, we're just pretending, or you lead them through kind of a critical thinking process in order to realize the truth for themselves, and then you can continue to play the game. What I really object to is tricking them, trying to squeeze more years of belief out of them by getting them to embrace magical explanations or accept bad evidence as good evidence or just believe because it's fun. That's the kind of stuff that I worry about.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I know a lot of parents who actually did that when our kids were growing up together, and their kids would ask, well, wait a minute, how could Santa go to all the houses at the same time? And then they would say something about like the time-space continuum being bent and trying to throw basically pseudoscience in there. It's like, no, don't introduce them to pseudoscience. What are you doing? It's like,
I completely agree. That is one of my big worries. Not my only worry, but it's one of my big worries is that we're basically encouraging our children to be credulous because they have to be to believe the Santa Claus lie. One of the analogies that I draw in the book is that, like, a lot of parents want to protect this because they want their kids to be naive and credulous for longer because it's a loss of innocence, right? But if my son started walking 3 months before he's kind of scheduled to, before he ordinarily would, right, I would not push him on the forehead and you know, push him down on his butt and say, no walking yet, you're too young, right? Or if he starts developing language skills too early, I wouldn't say, no language skills yet, you're too young. I want you to say, no, like, he's walking early, I'm so proud,
right?
Oh, he's talking early, I'm so proud. And he's thinking early, I'm so proud. Johnny was only 4 or 5, and he already figured out that Santa Claus doesn't exist. I'm so proud. Mm. I would not squelch it and say, oh, no, you should just keep going. Just keep believing, little Johnny, and just keep on going. No, it's celebrate the fact, because he's showing critical thinking early. It should be something that's embraced.
Mm. And I wonder if there is some kind of backfire effect. And I don't even know if there's any literature on this. I've never read anything in this area. But I would think that maybe if some kid was led on like that for a good portion of his childhood, and finally he just got too old to believe in anything and realized, holy crap, I've been tricked this entire time, and get really defensive. And then from that point on, have like these great critical thinking skills because he trusts nobody. So he questions everything from that point on.
Right. That's a possibility. Rebecca Watson actually presents a kind of argument that like that, where she basically says we should be lying to kids about Santa Claus, because really we should just be lying to them all the time. Not all the time, but parents should often lie to them because they need to be distrustful of authority.
Mm.
And so Santa Claus lies a good way to envision that,
right,
to enact that kind of distrust. I would disagree. I think it's an interesting point. I would disagree. I think that parents, that kids should trust their parents. They should be skeptical of authority in general, but they should at least trust their parents more than they, you know, trust the general public, trust other authorities. And so the Santa Claus lie would work against that.
Right. Okay. All right, well, let's move on to another myth that you have, the myth that Jesus is the reason for the season. I think we pretty much all know that that's not true, but why don't you just give us the summary on that one, why Jesus is not the reason for the season?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a short and a really long answer to this one, right? I imagine, like you said, most of your listeners probably do know that this is a myth, right? But the short answer is basically this. Jesus is not the reason for the season because seasonal celebrations in December, including birthday celebrations for gods on December 25th, existed long before Jesus would have been born and long before the church started celebrating anything in regards to anything at this time. And basically, Jesus was tacked on to existing celebrations. And so he is not the original reason that we celebrate at this time of year.
Hmm.
And in fact, I go into detail in the book, right? I talk about a lot of traditions that date back 2,000 years before Jesus would have been born. About 500 years before he was born, there's Roman festival Saturnalia, there's the Norse festival of Yule, and these have a lot of the same kind of elements that we still celebrate today.
Hello and welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Kimberly Ellington, and we're speaking with Dr. David Kyle Johnson about his book, The Myths That Stole Christmas.
Around 300, when Constantine converts and the church starts to try to get converts and that kind of stuff in a big way, because Rome was now supposed to be official religion. Around that time, the church declares, for no reason really whatsoever, that, or at least certainly no biblical reason whatsoever, that Jesus' birthday is on December 25th. I mean, the reason that they declared December 25th, actually, so I should say it wasn't done for any reason. It wasn't done for any biblical reason. There was no evidence that Jesus was born on that day. They declared December 25th to be Jesus' birthday because that's when sun worshippers were worshiping the birthday of their god Sol Invictus.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the religions were competing. And Christianity, I don't know if it began its tradition of this, but it certainly continued it after this, kind of accommodate, kind of adapt and adopt method of conversion, where you kind of bring in the elements of the religion you're competing with to get converts to come over. And that was, well, at least one of the first attempts to do so, right? So they declare December 25th to be Jesus' birthday. That way, they're not going to stop people from celebrating, right? So that way, when the people do continue to celebrate, you can basically say, oh, yeah, well, officially, like, what they're really celebrating is Jesus' birthday. That's what they're really doing.
Right.
People don't care as long as it's a party, and it just takes off from there. They try to, so that's like, so the origins of the holiday are not in Jesus. So Jesus is not the reason for the season in that way. He's not the causal explanation
right.
for why we celebrate. It really is it's a big giant harvest festival, basically, is what it is. But in addition, Jesus has never been the focus of, like, socially speaking, he's never been the focus of Christmas celebrations. Throughout the Middle Ages, it was like Saturnalia and that kind of stuff before Jesus was around, was a very, it was a festival of feasting, drinking, and sex. Mainly is what was going on. A little small gift giving, but mainly feasting, drinking, and sex. It continued to be that way all the way through the Middle Ages. It was never a somber religious holiday. The church tried to Christianize it to a certain degree by adding events in the calendar and like Advent and that kind of stuff, and some hymns and that. But it never caught on. It was always a primarily secular holiday celebrated in a secular way. So much so that the Puritans tried to ban it. That's how secular it remained all the way through the Middle Ages.
Huh, that's interesting. You know what? I think a lot of people have difficulty with perspective on this issue. So, for example, if you were brought up Christian and your Christmases really did focus around Jesus as the central figure, and it was very religious in that sense, you probably have a difficult time understanding people like us who celebrated Christmas ever since we were born, but we celebrated it in a very secular way, or what we could call the traditional way, in a sense. And I think that's the central problem. People just have difficult time with perspective and understanding that, yeah, okay, you may celebrate Jesus as the central figure, but that doesn't mean everybody else does. Now, Kim, I imagine that you, being raised atheist, that must have been even more secular than most of us, right?
I think probably. Yeah, I remember we had Christmas tree and we had presents and, you know, we sang Christmas carols and we read The Night Before Christmas.
Okay, the Christmas carols you sang, some of them must have had a religious theme to it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like the first, they're beautiful songs. Yeah. Just like many hymns, the music is absolutely gorgeous. The first Noel, I just love, not the words, but the music, absolutely gorgeous. So yeah, we sang them, but not with any, again, like everything that was Christian about it to me was just this, you know, it was a cool story.
Okay.
Which it still is, you know, it's a great story.
Yeah. All right, Kyle, so tell us about this big war on Christmas and what's up with Starbucks and their hatred towards Jesus.
Yeah, so... the Starbucks thing is so interesting. Let me come back to the Starbucks, though. Let's talk about the war. So basically, the idea that there is a war on Christmas is nothing new. It's actually been, for about 100 years, a very convenient way to demonize people on the other side of the aisle, as it were, and not just political aisle. Henry Ford, in his publication, The International Jew, he was anti-Semitic, basically declared that the Jews were waging a war on Christmas. In the 50s and 60s, the John Birch Society said it was a communist. In the late 90s, it was really right-wing conservatives saying that it was liberals. And then in 2005, it's basically Bill O'Reilly and Fox News saying that it was, you know, the liberals that were waging a war on Christmas. The problem is that almost all of the statements... Well, I will say all of the statements that they make are either just outright false or completely exaggerated. A couple of examples I mentioned in the book. A false statement, no school has ever banned the colors red and green at Christmas time. That's never happened. There's been multiple claims of that happening, and when you check into it, literally just completely made up.
Wow.
Lincoln Chafee, governor of Rhode Island, did call the Christmas tree that they had erected there at the Capitol a holiday tree. That did happen.
How dare he?
That's not a false claim. But what also happened is the Republican government of Rhode Island called it a holiday tree as well for like the prior 6, 7, 8 years before that, and no one made a peep. It wasn't until the Democrat did it, oh, now it's a war on Christmas, when the Republican was doing the same thing. Right? So you can see how these claims are just completely exaggerated.
Wow.
Right? So going with that, like, is Starbucks waging a war on Christmas, right? I think that there's... I actually wrote a blog on this for Psychology Today on the red cups, and there's some Santa displays that don't include reindeer or Christmas trees that some people were upset about. And I think that the the conservatives have got somewhat of a point here, but I think it's not quite the point that they want to make. So what Starbucks, I think, is trying to do is noble. They're trying not to offend people. And I think that there's something right in that, right? Like, I wouldn't say Happy Father's Day to someone who I didn't know was a father. I also wouldn't say to someone who was a Jew who was grieving their the loss of their son, I would not say something like, well, he's with Jesus now. Like, yeah. I wouldn't do that, right? And so in the same way, I can see the motivation behind not wanting to say Merry Christmas to someone who isn't Christian. But the problem with that is, I can kind of see the motivation behind it, but the problem with that is I don't think that Christmas really is a Christian word, and that Christmas itself, the holiday, is not a Christian holiday for some of the reasons that I've already talked about. So I think that those non-Christians who would be offended by someone saying Merry Christmas, I think are kind of giving in to the kind of Christian propaganda that suggests that the holiday belongs to them. When it never has. It wasn't originally a Christian holiday. It's never been celebrated primarily as a Christian holiday. Even when it was revived after the Puritans tried to stamp it out, it was revived as a primarily secular holiday. Of course, the word Christ is in Christmas, but the word Son is in Sunday. And that's actually where that name comes from. It's called Sunday because it was the day of the sun. It was the day of sun worshipers. Worship the sun, but that doesn't mean that people who worship on Sunday are worshiping the sun. Words are defined not by their origin, but by how people use them and by what their connotations actually have. And so when we think of Sunday worship now, we think of Christian worship. When we say the word Christmas, we don't normally think of Christ. We think of all of the secular symbols and celebrations that go along with it. This is why all the number one Christmas movies, none of them are religious. There, Miracle on 34th Street, Christmas Carol is a story, and Christmas Carol movies. I'm trying to think of another good one. White Christmas is one of the most popular ones, right? All secular tales, all the most well-selling and famous Christmas songs, all secular. And so I think that there's an exaggeration, basically, when it comes to that kind of worry. And what is so ironic about it is that the symbols that Starbucks removed from the cup were ornaments and snowflakes. It wasn't like, oh, there was a little baby Jesus on their coffee cup that they took off that was offending people, right? The symbols that were on it should have already been non-offensive. Yeah. I mean, does that seem fair? Does that seem right to you?
Yeah.
I think pretty much I don't know if this is the truth or not, but most of that was not, I don't know any Christians who were offended by that damn cup. I do not know one single one, and I have a lot of Christian friends. That was only on the internet. That whole thing that up was on the internet only.
Hmm. Yeah, it was a couple of people who made videos, right, that seemed to get really upset about it, right? And Donald Trump said that they should be boycotted or whatever, right? So there were some people who were maybe kind of taking advantage of it. But I have some Christian friends, too, who said the same thing, basically, that, if people were really upset about this, I'd be seeing it on my feed, because I have a lot of people, if I live in the Bible Belt, and I have friends, and I should be seeing it, and they weren't seeing it. So I think you're right. I think it was largely overblown, and those who were upset about it were upset for the wrong reason. But I think that those who would be offended by it, too, would be offended for the wrong reason.
All right, well, let's move on to myth number five that you have here. And this is an interesting one because I always thought, even till right now, I think that St. Nicholas is Santa Claus. But apparently he's not, is he?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite chapters. So the myth is that Santa is St. Nicholas, and I'm arguing that he's not. And what I mean by that is that the Santa Claus that we know and love today, mm-hmm. the way he looks, what he does, where he lives, his reindeer names, and all that kind of stuff, is not primarily influenced by St. Nicholas in any significant way. For one, it's not, I argue in the chapter, it's not clear that St. Nicholas actually existed as a historical person. That is not a popular opinion, but I think I lay out a pretty convincing case in the chapter that is not the case, that he did not exist as a historical person. but when you look at Santa Claus himself, like if you look at the Night Before Christmas, right, which is originally called A Visit from St. Nicholas, that was the original title of the poem, you start to wonder, how in the world could you possibly think, besides the name, St. Nicholas, that this character is based on a saint? What saint was ever dressed in fur from his head to his foot? What saint shook like a bowl full of jelly when he laughed and had rosy red cheeks and was covered in soot? Who was an elf? A lot of people don't realize, if you read the poem, Santa Claus, St. Nicholas in the poem, does not look like the Coca-Cola Santa Claus you see on the ads. He's an elf. He's a tiny elf with a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. It's all miniature. This is how he fits down the chimney. It's not magic. He doesn't squeeze through anything. He's just small. He fits through the chimney. The depiction, and no, St. Nicholas didn't smoke a pipe. The historical St. Nicholas certainly didn't have a giant white beard. And he did not fly around in a flying sleigh. Now, St. Nicholas in Europe does have fly around on a white horse, but that is actually influenced from Odin. That's Odin's horse, Sigmundur, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that was an 8-legged white flying horse. And so you don't see all of these elements. One of the books that I read in researching the book is called Skeefer. The author's called Skeefer, and the book's called Santa Claus Lasts the Wild Men. And she points out that if St. Nicholas is really, St. Nicholas, the poem, was really based on the saint, his reindeers would be named Faith, Hope, and Charity. That they have elemental names like Donder and Blitzen, which is thunder and lightning, right? Dancer and Prancer. I mean, this doesn't make sense as a saint. Incidentally, Thor rode around on a flying chariot pulled by 2 goats called Gnasher and Cracker, which is thunder and lightning as well. But when you look at the precursor for Santa Claus, and who really shares his attributes, right before him, more than likely, where Moore is Moore, who wrote the poem, is getting his influence, is a Pennsylvania character called Belznickel. Belznickel, basically, his name is Furry Nicholas, and he's dressed in fur from his head to his foot. He's very dirty and sooty, very much like a peddler, and he carries around a sack that's full of goodies, but he also carries around birch rods to whip bad children. And he also is, the reason he's called Belznickel is he has bells. Well, if we trace this back a little bit further, Belznickel actually is an agglomeration of 2 characters from European lore, St. Nicholas and his helper. And he has different names at different places. In Austria, which is my favorite version, a helper named Krampus. There's actually 2 horror films coming out this year about Krampus. Krampus is a half-man, half-goat, with horns, cloven feet, horrible, demonic-looking figure that serves as St. Nicholas's helper. People who dress up as him today, still in Austria, are covered in fur from their head to their foot. They are a lot more like the St. Nicholas of the poem than the Saint Nicholas that roams around Europe today with the big, the big bishop's hat, the mitre, and all that stuff, right? And so it looks like, so if you look at Belznickel, who influenced the Saint Nicholas of the poem more directly, he is much more Santa helper than he is Saint Nicholas. In fact, the bells on him are basically supposed to replicate the sound of the chains that Krampus has. So when Krampus comes, he's in chains, and you can hear them coming by the sound of the chains. Those chains turn into bells, essentially, over time for Krampus, but also smaller bells for the Belznickel. But that is also why you know Santa Claus is coming when you hear the ching, 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 ching jingle bells of the reindeer. They are announcing his arrival just like the chains announce the arrival of Krampus. So it's not that he's not based on St. Nicholas at all. It just seems that the much greater influence is the Krampus figure. And just to add just a little bit more to that, I argue that since St. Nicholas likely didn't exist as a historical person, St. Nicholas himself is likely just a sainted version of what Krampus is modeled after. Both St. Nicholas and Krampus can trace their origins back to an older fertility god that looks a lot like Krampus, that Skeeper calls the Wild Man, and that was often called Klaus. Klaus is, in German, short for Nicholas. In America, if your name's Nicholas, you have a nickname, your name's Nick. In German, you go by the latter half of your name, Klaus. And very often Christians would saint pagan gods, basically for that kind of adopt and adopt method, right? St. Martin is just Mars. I'm trying to think of a bunch of other ones. The Jesuits went, I talked about this in the book, the Jesuits went through and eradicated a bunch of saints from their calendar because they realized they were just pagan gods. My supposition is that this is what St. Nicholas is. He is a sainted version of that old Klaus wild man deity, and that whenever he was sainted, they called him by his first name and put saint in front of it, Saint Nicholas. That's my supposition.
So generally, we don't want the kids to believe in Santa Claus because we don't want them to have nightmares, is kind of what you're saying.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, you know, I've actually heard people express that their kids are kind of sometimes worried about, you know, Santa Claus coming in the house and that kind of stuff. Yeah, but if you talk about nightmares, Krampus will give them to you. Although there's arguments out there that he might be a little bit better figure than Santa Claus because he doesn't spoil children. He wants them to behave. That's why he punishes. That's where Belznickel's sack comes from, is from Krampus. Krampus has a sack. He carries it on his back, and he stuffs bad children in the sack and hauls them off the hell if they've been naughty.
Yeah, nothing like a little Christmas corporal punishment to whip you back in shape.
Yes. There are some wonderful pictures. I don't know if the version of the book that you guys have had him in there, but there are some wonderful pictures of, like, old postcards and stuff that have Krampus in them. And they are wonderful. They're magnificent. They're ridiculous. A wonderful artist named Monty Duchamp gave me permission to use a few of his pictures in the book, and they are wonderful, along with another artist, a contemporary artist named Brahm, who has a wonderful depiction of Krampus, and another artist named King Skinny, who did some customized work for me for the book as well.
Nice.
I'm Kim Ellington, here with my co-host, Bo Bennett, and we're talking to Dr. David Kyle Johnson about the seven myths of Christmas. I want to talk about Christmas and sex. I think we need to bring more of this back. I think we'll get a lot more non-believers on board, and maybe even a whole lot more believers if we start adding the old traditions back.
Yes, so sex is actually one of the oldest traditions when it comes to December holiday celebrations, and it has to do with how it originated. Basically, December was a time to celebrate agricultural societies because it was the only time that you had fresh food and drink, because the harvest was in, and you were calling the herds, basically, so they could survive winter. So it's the only time you had fresh meat. You had fresh, you know, fresh wine and that kind of stuff, because you now had grain to ferment and all that good stuff. And so it was, and there was no work to be done. The harvest was done. You couldn't plant in the spring. So it was your time off, basically. So you're fattening up for the winter. You have all this food and alcohol. And, of course, with lots of alcohol comes lots and lots of sex. And that's one of the reasons the Puritans hated it so much, is because there was so much sex involved with Christmas celebrations all the way through the Middle Ages, even into the 15th and 16th and 1700s, where you would even see, you know, a rise of birth 9 months later after Christmas, right? There's a lot of people getting pregnant at Christmas because there was so much sex involved. One of the places in the book, I talk about a researcher who, I think it was in Ireland, as late as the 1800s, was observing, they would do Christ's Mass at midnight, but they would do it outside. It was lit by bonfires, and it was bookended by orgies. They were having sex, they'd do a little Mass, and then they would go back to having sex. So, you know, the only place it kind of survives today is at office Christmas parties, but turned up the notch a little bit. I think that... you know, I think people could definitely get more enthusiastic about celebrating Christmas if it involved that. I think you're exactly right.
I think we just have a new idea for a movement on our hands.
Woohoo!
Yeah, the Christmas sex movement, man. I'm on board.
All right.
I think you just started it.
You
We're giving you full credit.
So, Kyle, what's the ultimate goal for this book?
I'm really trying to argue that people, I start and end the book expressing, I think, a lot of frustrations, I think, that people share about Christmas, that they dread it in a lot of kind of ways, a lot of the traditions they don't like, or they, you know, they feel roped into, you know, buying gifts or celebrating a certain way. And basically what I'm trying to do is get people to realize that they don't have to celebrate Christmas in a way that is dictated to them by others or society. That Christmas is always in flux. It's always changing. It always has been. It always will be. There's no one right or wrong way to celebrate the holiday. Mm-hmm. That you really can make it, make your celebrations whatever you want it to be. And there's no reason to feel guilty. There's no reason to feel that you're doing it wrong, or that you're, in many cases, people don't do it because they are sacrificing or giving up on some ancient, old, old tradition, when it turns out that tradition is only about 50 years old, or at most 200 years old, like the Christmas tree. Christmas tree is only about, it's only been popular for about 200 years, and really has only been in existence for about 500 years. And so I'm wanting people to own the way they celebrate Christmas and to feel free to celebrate whatever way is best for them. So if they can't afford gifts, it's okay not to give gifts. It really is. If they feel like they're wasting money, which they likely are, by giving a gift to their boss or giving gifts up the social ladder instead of down, they really can not do that anymore. And it's okay that the idea that we should give gifts to everyone that we know was literally an idea that was promoted to us by advertising. That was not right. Even giving gifts to children was something that was basically not advertising per se, but kind of a propaganda campaign.
Sure.
To change what Christmas was in the early 1800s. Hmm. And that we can, once we realize that, we can change the way we celebrate and make it a better holiday for each one of us. I'm not trying to advocate that everyone celebrate my way. Not at all. I may be making a couple suggestions about ways that we might make gift giving more less wasteful and more efficient and that kind of stuff. But ultimately, it comes down to you really ought to celebrate the way that's best for you.
All right, that's great. And we have three other myths that we did not cover. So just to let our audience know, our Christmas traditions are old-fashioned is another myth. Christmas spending is good for the economy, and Christmas can't change. So if you want to know the secrets behind those myths, then you're going to have to buy the book. And where could they do that, Kyle?
Well, they should be able to buy it on Amazon, I'm hoping in the next couple of days. It should be on Amazon at least by November 20th. And, of course, you can pre-order it from the Humanist Press website anytime now, and it should be available to buy on November 20th. And it'll be available as an ebook, and then also as a paperback. And I'm not sure how many bookstores that we will be in, but I'm hoping to see it at Barnes & Noble and that kind of stuff as well.
All right.
So, yeah, but, I mean, Amazon's a place to go for books anyway, right? That's where everybody buys them. So
that's where everyone does it.
Place to go.
All right. This has been great. Very interesting stuff. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed the interview.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this segment of the Humanist Hour. My name is Patty Trainer, and my guest today is Kevin Davis, Executive Director of the Young Skeptics. This is an after-school program for elementary school children. Back in August on the Humanist Hour, Bo talked with David Niosi in a back-to-school episode. David discussed potential problems humanists and atheist parents might discover at school and how to deal with those issues. Since my kids are grown adults, problems like that have been off my radar for a little while. And then in September, I saw Kevin's presentation about the Young Skeptics during PostaCon, the Pennsylvania State Atheist Humanist Conference. So with that, I'd like to welcome Kevin. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Patty. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to talk to you. So tell us about Young Skeptics, Kevin. Your group has come up with a great alternative, it seems, to the Good News Club for Young Kids.
Sure. So Young Skeptics was kind of the result of a few of us from the Atheist Community of Rochester, which is our meetup group in Rochester, New York, coming together to discuss our recent kind of reading of Catherine Stewart's book, The Good News Club.
Okay.
A few of us got together and talked about, you know, what we found in the book and you know, what we could possibly do to counteract these groups if they existed in our area. And what we found out was that there was one Good News Club in our area, which happened to be in the school district that I lived in.
Okay.
So after kind of going back and forth over what could be done, and, you know, we couldn't do much about them existing there except just monitoring what they're doing and making sure that they're not violating district policies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of going right at the Good News Club and, you know, being that adversarial atheist group and kind of feeding into the stereotype that atheists have as being, you know, the angry anti-religion people.
Right.
We wanted to do something positive. So what we did was we thought, okay, let's start an atheist group for kids, you know, kind of the opposite of the Good News Club.
Mm-hmm.
But then we thought more about that, and we thought we could easily be accused of doing the same thing, you know, trying to indoctrinate children and spreading our atheism to kids and that kind of thing. And that's not really what we wanted to do. And
mm-hmm.
if you really think about it, having kind of lessons for elementary school kids about atheism, you don't really have a lot of content to draw from there, right? So your first... Your first meeting is, okay, what is atheism? Atheism is not a belief, you know, a belief that that gods don't exist and that kind of thing. And you're kind of done.
Right.
So, you know, what we wanted to do is really arm kids with the tools to be able to make their own belief decisions, whether it was about religion, which we really don't focus on, but, it's about the world around them. So it could be nature. It could be things that they're told. It could be things they see on the internet. It could be, you know, whatever they come across. Being able to process that information and really apply critical thinking skills. So that's what our group's about.
That sounds great. So you started this in your school district there in New York, and you just did it for last school year?
Right. So we started our pilot group in the Churchville Chile School District in a suburb of Rochester, New York. And it was the same school that the Good News Club was in. So we wanted to provide that alternative to not only students, but parents, you know, who wanted to send their kids to a group that's going to focus on critical thinking and problem solving and give them a safe space to explore their questions and, you know, kind of test hypotheses that they have and things like that. So we wanted to be able to do it in the same school where not only could kids have an alternative, but you could also have kids that go to the Good News Club that might also go to this club. We didn't have them on the same night as the Good News Club so that we could be open to all faiths and all backgrounds and let everyone have a chance to see what we were about. So we started in our district. We held the, I believe, 6 sessions.
Okay.
And then, you know, the pilot was pretty successful. Attendance was fairly low just because it was tough to get word out to parents. You know, groups like this, you don't have the support of the school because we're independent and just using school facilities. So
right.
The school doesn't do anything to promote the club or anything like that. So it's all on us.
Right.
So we did some things in the media, we did a lot of interviews and things like that, and did what we could to get some kids in the door. And of course we were kind of confronted with a little bit of bad press and people, you know, finding out that we were, you know, born of the atheist community of Rochester and trying to paint us in a negative light, even though our group isn't about religion at all. So
mm-hmm.
the pilot went fairly well as far as, you know, the kids responding to the content and enjoying themselves and learning, and showing each, you know, through each session and afterwards that they were kind of coming along and understanding the message that we were giving them, and that was, you know, to ask questions, and it's okay to you know, to challenge what you're being told, and it's okay to have different opinions, and let's explore those things and really learn together, you know, and apply those critical thinking skills. So we decided to, you know, focus our attention this year on building our curriculum. So we kind of took the group offline. We're not in the school this year. So we're working on expanding the group nationwide to other organizations and groups around the country that have contacted us. They wanted to start a group. So we're kind of packaging all of our curriculum, expanding on it right now, and coming up with a little kind of a how-to guide to starting a Young Skeptics group in your own town.
That's a really great idea. After I saw your presentation, I came home and looked up in my county in Pennsylvania where I live. There are 17 different school districts that have Good News Clubs, which was quite disconcerting. So what does a person like me or, you know, my local group, what do we do to contact you and get started on something like this?
Sure. So you can go to the website. It's youngskeptics.net. Mm-hmm. There's some information there as far as what we're about, and you know, some more information about some of the things I've talked about. There's a contact form that actually goes to me right now for those who are interested in either volunteering or starting a group. And we have kind of a working list of groups that are interested and people that are interested. Mm-hmm. Soon I will be actually posting some positions within our organization for those who want to take kind of a really active role in creating curriculum. That's really where we need it the most right now. And outreach for volunteers and things like that. So we're still fleshing those out as far as how many people we need and what kind of quote-unquote job descriptions we're looking for and that kind of thing. And those should be posted probably within the next month or so.
Oh, good. Okay. So you're going to be looking for things like maybe teachers that know how to teach science or something like that? Or
yeah, that would be great. We're looking for people that are experienced in, you know, in this area, whether it's creating lesson plans or facilitator guides, coming up with lesson topics, and really putting on paper what we want to, you know, the activities that we want to do with kids. And, you know, having teaching experience is certainly great. You know, anything working with kids, that kind of drive to get kids thinking critically. And really we're looking for a passion to be able to want to do this kind of thing. And
it's all volunteers, I'm sure. Are you going to have information that groups can print out or a package that your organization provides? How's that all going to work? Do you know?
All right, so we'll have a package that we can provide, and it'll be mostly, hopefully, electronically, you know, handed out. So it'll be our curriculum and kind of a step-by-step how-to guide on how to start a group. Right now, we're hoping that we can do it for as little cost as possible. There are some costs in running our group and having insurance, and you know, in some areas there are facilities. Use costs and things like that. So we're trying to keep our costs low. We're hoping to add other groups under our umbrella. So we're incorporated. We have all of our logos and name and everything are trademarked. So we're hoping to basically create other chapters under our umbrella, and we will have a charter that we send out that's kind of our, you know, rules and regulations of how to, you know, stay under our name and that kind of thing. It's following our mission and values and that kind of thing. So we're hoping that we can provide the insurance through us. We're still exploring that with our insurance company to see what it would cost on our end. And, you know, we would want the local groups to at least be able to contribute that difference. So rather than have them start from scratch, we're looking to kind of collaborate and be able to keep things low for everybody and do it that way.
And you're a nonprofit, right?
Correct. We're a nonprofit.
So people can donate to your organization, and that will help for the nationwide rollout.
Right. We have a donate page on our website also for those that, you know, may not be able to donate their time, but may be able to donate some funds to help us expand and reach more kids. There's a link on our website, and 100% of money collected there is used towards our materials, our insurance, our administrative costs. And no one in the organization takes any sort of pay or anything like that.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin. Our time is up about here, and I really appreciate the work that your group has been doing, and I think that our local community is going to be looking into it, and I have a feeling a lot of people across the country are going to do the same.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.
Again, to volunteer, to donate, or to find out more information, the website address is youngskeptics.net. This is Patty Trainer for the Humanist Hour. Now back to you, Bo.
Thank you, Patty. You know, the whole talk of the good news and the Good News Club made me think of something Dan Barker once said in one of his speeches, and I did manage to find a clip on YouTube, so I'm just going to play that and leave you with that. Here we go.
Suppose you were walking by my house one day. You've been walking by for a long time. And I were to go up on the porch and say, "Hey, stop, I've got some good news. Good news for you people. Stop, stop, stop. You don't have to go down in my basement. This is great news. You've been walking by all this time. You've been ignoring me. And I deserve to be recognized and honored. And you've been ignoring me, and it's made me so angry.
And so mad, and I just get so horribly mad, so I built this torture chamber down in the basement. And there's some hooks down there, and there's some sharp things, and there's some vats of sneaky stuff, and there's a furnace, and there's some chains, and it's horrible, and there's flames. But you don't have to go down there. I sent my son down there. And it was gruesome. I tell you, it was really horrible. But that satisfied my anger. And now his blood was shed, and now you're free. You don't have to go down. All you have to do, come on up here. Just come up and tell my son that you love him and hug him, and then you can move in with us. We'll live up in the attic, and you can tell me how great I am. You can just tell me how much you love me, and we'll do that. Won't that be great? So would you keep walking?
All right, well, that will wrap it up for this episode. Kim, did you have fun?
I did have fun, and now I am even more excited for Christmas, quite honestly.
As am I. All right, so we did our job. Okay, well, folks, if you have any comments, we'd love to hear from you. You could send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org, or you could call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. We'd love to hear from you. So until next time, bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.